Welcome to Culture at a Crossroads. I'm David Mann. This is the podcast where we explore the intersection of faith and culture in Canada. And we do that by chatting with the very influential Canadians at the center of our cultural shifts. We're also going to dive into what this means for Christians, for followers of Jesus. Let's get to it. My guest this week is Mary Scott Greenwood. She's the president of the Canadian American Business Council, also a former chief of staff for the U.S. Embassy in Canada. Before we dive into everything Canada-U.S., we do want to thank our sponsors. Culture at a Crossroads is in partnership with John Topping and the Ultimate Questions podcast. This Power to Change podcast is all about equipping you to understand the legitimate arguments supporting the Christian faith. John is a professor and he's a very smart guy, but he does a great job at breaking down these complex concepts in a way that we can all understand. And he does so in less than 20-minute increments, so it's very short. Culture at a Crossroads is also brought to you by Emmanuel Plus. You've got song, story, and significant discussion from a church that wants to ensure you're consuming what is noble and excellent throughout the week. Now let's get to this week's episode. She is the first American to ever come on the show. We're all about Canada on Culture at a Crossroads, what can I say? However, she is an expert on our country, particularly in terms of the U.S.-Canada relationship. Ever since leaving her job at the embassy, Mary Scott has been consulting firms on both sides of the border, and she's been keeping the Canadian American Business Council afloat. It's a vital resource for both countries. Given that the U.S. election is still relatively fresh, we're going to explore with her what the eventual change in White House will mean for trade, commerce, climate change, and yes, even China in Canada. We're also going to look back on what the Trump administration has accomplished that will help and hurt the Canada-U.S. relationship going forward. Let's get to it. With me for some reaction on Canada-U.S. relations, we've got Mary Scott Greenwood. Thanks for coming on the show.
Sure thing. Great to be with you.
So, Mary Scott, let's just start right off with what is still on people's minds, you know, these few weeks since the American election. How does a change of Trump as president of the states affect the relationship for Canada?
Well, David, first of all, I think we'll have a return to decorum. You know, we'll have a return to people being kind to each other and no name calling as a matter of U.S. foreign policy. So that's a positive. I also think we'll see with the president-elect, with President-elect Biden and Harris, you won't see a weaponization of tariffs the way we have over the last 4 years. So all of that is a positive in terms of Canada-U.S. Not to say the relationship has been all bad over the last 4 years. It hasn't. There have been lots of good things. But I think a return to decorum and getting rid of those punitive tariffs as a constant threat hanging over the bilateral relationship, those are both very positive.
Why don't we start off with some of those positives from the last 4 years? I know a lot of people aren't talking about them as much in mainstream media, but the things that I can think of from here north of the border is that there's been a strong, you know, partisanship in terms of border security and cracking down on illegal immigration, also cybersecurity, and just really having a strong defense. Do you think that will continue?
So what I see as a positive is the new trade agreement between Canada, United States, and Mexico. Yeah, I think the fact that we were able to take what was a pretty good trade agreement, the NAFTA, and make it even better is something that is a major accomplishment. And you have to give credit to the three leaders of the three countries for doing that. But also, it's pretty unusual because despite the intense partisanship here in the United States, you know, the new trade agreement, which was negotiated by the Trump administration, managed to get approved by House Democrats and by the Senate. So that in and of itself is quite noteworthy. And it's something that will be a model for trade agreements, you know, I think for an entire generation.
What do you think makes it better than the previously put in place NAFTA?
Well, a few things. One is just it's more modern. So NAFTA was written and passed at a time when, for example, e-commerce didn't exist. Right. So we didn't have any rules of the road for e-commerce and we needed to do that. And so the new USMCA deals with digital trade and deals with intellectual property and things like that in a way that's much more modern. So I think that's pretty good.
And as far as the, you know, response from the countries, I know, you know, things were quite tense. And in those negotiations a couple of years ago, it started off as being really backing the America First agenda in the States. You see that it's maybe actually helped relationships and trade all across the board for Canada and Mexico too?
I think the relationships were strained, but they got through it. The commerce has been really good. Obviously, with the pandemic, you know, there's kind of a different approach to commerce. You don't have totally open borders right now for good reasons, but the trade agreement itself is helping, and it's going to help, you know, small businesses, not just large businesses. It's going to help farmers in all three countries, the auto industry, like right across the board. I think there are benefits.
And just going back to, you know, the relationship between the two countries, it was just renewed again. Today it came out in Canada. I'm not sure what the news in the States has come out for that are restrictions for between both borders is extended for another month, except for family. In terms of the border, like this is, I would think to be a strength of Trump's administration that there is strong security, and that does benefit Canada in the sense that if there was illegal immigration that was damaging to the States, it's also not going to get into Canada, and there's just like protection that we benefit from, like as your, you know, younger sibling. Do you think that the Biden administration will keep that rhetoric going forward?
So, you know, respectfully, David, I don't entirely accept the premise. I would say that our border security with Canada is a result of cooperation between Canada and the United States that has been ongoing for many, many decades. So the intelligence sharing and the security relationship between the United States and Canada is really a model for the world. It really is, you know, maybe the best functioning border on earth. So that benefits Canada and it benefits the United States as well. So that was my slight quibble with the framing of the question. So I do see that continuing. I do see the Biden administration understanding the importance of Canada as a neighbor and as an ally. And, you know, those kinds of deep security arrangements are not partisan, you know, and they do withstand the test of time and they withstand the change in administration. So I see that continuing.
And in terms of the relationship and the less surprises that I'm sure many people are expecting with Biden from a more unpredictable person in office in Donald Trump, how do you see that to be most advantageous for Canada in terms of who we have in office right now in Prime Minister Trudeau?
Well, yeah, fewer surprises are better. So Trudeau's a known quantity, Biden's a known quantity. So I think the relationship will be just fine. Biden and Trudeau have already spoken. One of the interesting things, though, is in the election, it wasn't just the presidency that was on the ballot, but also the House and Senate. And, you know, some people expected a big blue tidal wave, they called it. They thought, you know, not only would Biden win by a lot, which he did, but also maybe the Senate would change hands from Republicans to Democrats, and maybe the House Democrats would pick up a few seats. And we didn't see that. We didn't see that big wave. What we saw was actually Republicans picked up seats in the United States House. The Democrats still control it, but they lost ground. And they have their smallest governing majority that they've had, you know, in many, many years. But also the United States Senate is still, we don't know who's going to control it, Republicans or Democrats. There's a runoff election in Georgia. And what that means is, you know, whatever ambitions and aspirations that the progressive wing of the Democratic Party had with the election of Biden have to be moderated. You know, here in the United States, it's not just who's in the White House, but with our separate branches of government and our the equal weight that we give, the Senate's actually really relevant. So what that means is Biden's progressive wing of the party is going to have to confront the reality of a deeply divided Senate, which means we're going to have gridlock. And that's not, gridlock's not always a bad thing. Like our system was designed for gridlock. We were designed to protect against too much power at the center. And so you're going to see a moderation and a coming to the center, not too far left, not too far right. I think that'll be the hallmark of the Biden administration. And I think that'll be fairly straightforward for our partners, including Canada, to navigate.
Just going into the Senate, if it does change hands and become Democratic, you foresee that there still will be a gridlock because it's still going to be a very small margin?
Yeah, that's exactly right, David. I mean, in the U.S. Senate, you have to have a supermajority to get anything done, which means you got to get 60 votes, not just 50. There's 100 senators. And in order to move forward on any legislation, you got to get at least 60. So that means even if the Democrats manage to pick up these two seats in Georgia and the Senate's essentially tied, Kamala Harris becomes the tiebreaker, the vice president is the president pro tem of the Senate, that's why they get to break the tie. Even in that scenario, you would still, to get anything done, you'd have to get 9 Republicans, you know, out of 49. So that what that means is you can't be too extreme one way or the other.
Yeah, it's interesting that the parallels we're seeing between both countries, because Canada, as I'm sure you know, last year it changed from hands from a majority to a minority government. And so there's that same sort of need for support and understanding from, you know, opposition parties to get things move forward. And the states are kind of in a similar boat right now.
Yeah, that's right. The one difference I would say, though, in Canada, it makes it more tenuous and less secure, right? You could call an election at any time. You could lose a confidence vote at any time. You may go into an election this spring, I guess. In the U.S., the gridlock is actually kind of a sense of stability. Our elections are set and our party mandates are clear. So it's, you're right, there are some similarities, but there's that difference in it's less tenuous down here than it is up there in a minority system.
Interesting insight. And let's dive into your particular passion for the relationship between Canada and the U.S. You've spent some time living in Canada, I understand, back when you were chief of staff at the U.S. Embassy here. And how did you get on this path?
So I served at the U.S. Embassy in Ottawa for 4 years. It was a great privilege. It's always great to be an American diplomat, but it was amazing to be able to do that in Canada. I had the wonderful opportunity to travel the entire country. I think I've seen more of Canada than a lot of Canadians. I continue to, you know, back when we were traveling, I continue in my work with Canadian American Business Council and with other clients to travel the country quite a lot, including up north and including East Coast, West Coast, prairies, you know, you name it, big cities, small towns. So I really, as you might say, I have a lot of time for Canada and really enjoy that. It started, though, actually, David, I can tell you this little known fact. When I was in high school in Arlington, Virginia, I was in the band and the orchestra, and we had a band trip to Montreal. So that was one of the spectacular high school experiences. We were in a competition. I met a couple of Canadians up there, one of whom I'm still friends with back from all those days. So started early with the admiration for all things maple.
What an interesting first impression of Canada, too, to go to a place like Montreal of the whole country that sort of has this European feel that I'd imagine is a lot different than the States. Did you get that sense even back in high school?
It was really great to be able to experience Montreal, to hear people speaking French and to experience St. Catherine Street. You know, my friend Debbie Thomas, my best friend from kindergarten, she's still my best friend. We were there together. We both played trombone and we met a kid named Art Babin. And Art was from London, Ontario. And we ended up palling around with Art. And if you fast forward all of these millions of years, Art had a very distinguished career in the RCMP. He and his wife live in Kamloops, BC now. And through the magic of social media and everything else, we reconnected. And we talk from time to time and see each other from time to time. And it all started back in Montreal.
And we weren't able to recruit you to stay here, you know, full time after your stint at the embassy?
Nobody wanted me. It was like, go back home, American. You know, the ambassador and I stayed on for several months during the transition. It was the 2000 election, so Bush versus Gore. And we didn't know the outcome of that election, as you know, until December when the U.S. Supreme Court decided to stop the recount. So Bush was the president-elect. That administration asked us to stick around in Canada until a successor could be named, because the free trade area of the Americas was being negotiated, and the view of the White House was they wanted some continuity. So we stayed for that. Ambassador Giffen's successor, my boss's successor, was the governor of Massachusetts, a guy named Paul Cellucci, God rest his soul, wonderful, wonderful person who has since passed away. So we stuck around long enough for Cellucci to get there and get warmed up, and then we returned to the U.S. and passed the baton over to him. So there have been a series of really terrific U.S. ambassadors to Canada, I have to say. And you may have seen some of them in our big celebration. It's still on YouTube, our State of the Relationship. Ambassador David Wilkins from South Carolina participated, Ambassador Kelly Craft, Gordon Giffen, of course, the ambassador that I worked for. So There's been a long line of great ambassador, great people from the U.S. posted in Canada. It's a hot commodity to get appointed to go there. And I would say the same is true. Canada has sent some of its finest to Washington to represent you, including the current ambassador, Kirsten Hillman, who is just spectacular.
That's kind of you to say that. Take me back to those years when you were in Ottawa for a moment. I mean, you already had this deep appreciation for everything maple, as you said, but was there even more of like a solidifying sense that this is a relationship unlike no other between Canada and the States? Was that just really hammered home to you?
It really did, David. And when you think about the magnitude of the issues that we deal with, so the commercial relationship is, of course, huge. It's the biggest in the world at $700 billion a year. So that's pretty overwhelming. But then you also have the military cooperation, and Canada and the United States cooperate all over the world together, really. So we have a very special relationship. When we were there, it was in the Bosnian conflict. But you fast forward to more recent years, to Afghanistan, and then now in other places around the world. So you've got the commerce and the trade, which is extremely large. You have military, and then you have environmental issues. Years ago, it was the Acid Rain Treaty. It started out with the Boundary Waters Treaty in 1909, one of the oldest environmental treaties in the world. You also have the Columbia River Treaty. So Canada and the United States have figured out how to together be stewards and shepherds of this piece of earth that we share. So commercial, military, environmental, and then you also have just the big issues of living next door to each other, right? So our communities are pretty integrated, particularly along the northern border. There's a congressman, John LaFalse, from upstate New York. And, his whole time, he's retired now, but his whole time in Congress, his wife said, "Now, when you finally get out of Congress, we've got to get a cottage in Crystal Beach," which is in Fort Erie, Ontario. And, lo and behold, they did. So they spend every summer, they leave Buffalo, they go over to Ontario, and, they're summer people, right? They love it. I could say the same about my in-laws in Vermont. We get Canadians from Quebec coming into Newport, Vermont, down Lake Memphamagog, same thing. And that happens all across our entire border. There's a lot of water on our border, and a lot of people enjoy the lakes and whatever. But that all kind of came to a halt this summer with the border closure. And so that the fabric of how integrated we are, families going back and forth across, snowbirds coming in the winter, the summer people going back and forth on the lakes, all of that has been temporarily paused. We're in this state of suspended animation with the borders closed. And that's, I don't want to normalize that. We've got to, at some point, in a safe way, get back to the ability to live as connected as we always have. That's one of the special things about this relationship that, we don't want to take for granted.
I'm with you. When we get back to that place, you said you've traveled throughout Canada. You've spent a lot of time here. Is there a particular spot in our country that you have, most appreciation for?
Oh, man. Okay. So there's a couple. If you haven't been to Churchill, Manitoba, up on the shores of the Hudson Bay, can you even call yourself Canadian? Because, man, place, it's so great.
I've been slated.
It's so great. And it's famous for the polar bears. They come every summer because the ice on the bay melts. And the polar bears are spectacular and magnificent. And it's cool to do that. You got to stay at the Lazy Bear Lodge with Wally Daudrich and his wife, Dawn, and all their kids. So that's amazing. But not only that, you can kayak with beluga whales in the Churchill River. And it's an amazing experience. There's such a connection to nature and to other creatures on Earth. It's the largest population, actually, of whales on the planet is the Western Hudson Bay belugas. So, that's right at the top of my list. I think it should be at the top of every Canadian's list for sure, because you don't have to quarantine when you come back, I don't think. I also really like British Columbia. Kitimat, British Columbia is a place that has natural beauty, and it has incredible industry, too. You've got a major aluminum facility there. You've got a liquefied natural gas facility. You've got partnerships with the Indigenous and First Nations there that work really well. So those are two places that I like a lot. And then going all the way across the other side of the country, I really like Nova Scotia. I really like the Cabot Trail. So those are places that I highly recommend. I was just with the Tourism Industry Association of Canada talking about my favorite places to go and talking about the fact that, you know, Canadians that have the opportunity to travel, that are fortunate enough to be able to go someplace, you know, if you live in Vancouver, you go to Hawaii or Palm Springs or Arizona. And if you live in Montreal, you might go to Florida. And I was saying, you know, if you have the means in Canada to travel, traveling in Canada and checking out what a diverse and beautiful place it is. I'll give you one more, David. Yellowega Lake in northern Saskatchewan. The fishing there is mind-blowing. I never understood fishing, to be honest, and I never really did it. You know, I thought, you know, what's the fun of that? I just didn't get it. And I was up with a business group in to look at a uranium mine owned by Cameco, a great Canadian company. And the company has a fishing lodge in northern Saskatchewan. And so we went fishing, and you're catching trophy fish. Like you just barely put your rod in, and it's, you know, you barely send it in, and like a few seconds later, major pull, and you reel it in, and you've got this giant, you know, pike or, you know, trout. They have all, anyway, Lake Yellowega was also mind blowing. The other thing about it is you feel like you're the only person on earth. You feel like no one else has been there. There's one camp on this entire lake, and it's on the outside, it's plywood and bare wire, and on the inside, it's the Ritz-Carlton. It's the wildest thing in the world. And you're eating for dinner, you're eating, you know, fish that you caught in the lake that day. It's really wonderful.
Wow, look at that. We've got an American telling Canadians where to go in our country. This is good.
Yeah, that's presumptuous of me, isn't it? You'd expect that of American to boss you around a little bit. That's,
you know. Maybe there's a little bit of truth to that sentiment. I think I'll have to let our listeners decide that. But no, we need that sometimes. We can be too passive up here in Canada.
Well, no, you asked me what I, you know, what I like, what my spots were. I can't pick one. So I like the cities too, but my favorite places are those remote places in Canada for sure.
I'm with you. I like the rural a little bit more. Just a little bit more about yourself before we kind of delve back into some of the big sort of things that are being explored as the Biden administration eventually takes over. So you got into politics. You spent some time with the Democratic Party in the Georgia area.
In the great state of Georgia, that's right.
I mean, you had this exposure to Canada, but how did politics really get on your radar?
Well, I hadn't had much exposure to Canada except that one high school trip. And then I went to the University of Vermont, and so we did a little bit of skiing and a few trips in Canada, but hadn't had a lot of exposure. I got to Georgia because my college boyfriend, now my husband, went to law school down there. There was an opportunity at the Democratic National Convention, actually, for internships. So I did an internship, ended up getting involved in politics. And in that 92 campaign, that's the last time a Democrat carried Georgia. You know, Joe Biden carried Georgia this time, but it's been Republican ever since. So we were involved in politics back in 92. There was a Senate runoff in Georgia. So it's amazing, you know, you wait around long enough and history repeats itself, right? So that was the last time we had a Senate runoff in Georgia as well. And then in 96, I worked for the mayor of Atlanta, and Atlanta hosted the Olympic Games, the Centennial Olympic Games, and that was spectacular and a great experience. So that's kind of how it all started. I moved for a guy.
Right on. Very romantic. I'm glad that it's kept on.
It worked out. You know, we got married. We have wonderful family. We, you know, he still puts up with me. So I lucked out.
Here we are, 2020, and you've got this understanding, really a good pulse on American politics, on Canada, on how the countries operate together. Let's just delve into a couple of these issues quickly. You know, and you brought this up, you're really wanting to highlight this when you said about your time up here in Ottawa, that the climate relationship is one that is noteworthy between our two countries. And so we know that Biden is far more in favor of things that promote climate change than, you know, what will be his soon predecessor. Talk to me about that for a second, about how this will help both countries mutually. We know that the states are expected to go back in the Paris Climate Treaty, but also things like hydroelectricity between Quebec and Massachusetts and hydro that could go between the prairies and some of the northern American states. How could this really help both countries in not just, you know, doing better to not, you know, emit stuff into our environment, but also, you know, economically as we work together?
Yeah, you're right. I think there's a huge opportunity to get back to North American collaboration on on sustainable projects. So hydroelectricity is a good example of that. You know, hydroelectricity coming into the United States is something, but also, you know, hydro fuels aluminum production in Canada, and the U.S. needs, so if you can get like relatively low carbon aluminum from Canada, why would you buy it from China, for example? So I think there's a real opportunity there. There are also, I think you'll see collaboration on low emission fuel standards, things like that are low hanging fruit, carbon capture and utilization. So we used to talk about carbon capture and storage. You know, you'd take it and put it in the ground. Now there's a wonderful Canadian company that I'm familiar with, do some work with, called Capital Power. And they've figured out, they've partnered with an inventor who has figured out how to pull carbon out of the air, put it into nanotubes, and the nanotubes can be mixed in with cement. So you can actually build infrastructure, lower emissions, reduce your carbon, and utilize it for something. So there are really exciting projects like that that I see a lot of, you know, Canada-US collaboration on the horizon. And that the Capital Power project that I mentioned is a finalist for the Carbon X Prize. So there's, you know, there's all sorts of incentives, but it has, you know, there are testing facilities for that particular technology, both in Saskatchewan and also in Wyoming. So you're seeing, and also Alberta, I should say. So you're seeing an effort that I think will be accelerated to figure out how do we grow economically? How do we build infrastructure? How do we help our economy recover? But how do we do it in a way that's environmentally responsible? And Canada and the United States have, you know, just decades of experience on how to develop resources responsibly. So I think we can lead the way in that.
Very exciting. And with Biden's centrist approach, I think both countries are looking forward to the optimism around still preserving, you know, some of these natural resources that have helped both countries going forward. But there is that Keystone project that, you know, up in Canada, we're still a little uncertain what Biden will do with that. I've read some that have said, you know, it's kind of a done deal in a lot of ways. So to stop that going down to the States from Alberta would be difficult. But at the same time, he has vocalized some that he might, you know, sever ties. What do you think could happen on that front?
So, you know, I'm not sure what would happen, David, but what I do know is that Keystone is not your grandmother's pipeline. Keystone is a very modern, the KXL project is very modern in so many ways. There has been so much progress made in terms of the carbon footprint, in terms of partnerships with First Nations, and also with labor unions, you know. That project puts a lot of people to work, and it transports a product to market in the most modern and safe way you can imagine. So I think there are some sort of old thoughts about Keystone XL that are kind of out of date, and it'll be interesting to see if the policymakers catch up with the reality of the project.
You think that there's other ways for oil to be maximized in both countries, or you think that the whole thing should be kind of just slowly kiboshed, in your opinion?
Oh, look, we are reliant on fossil fuels even as we transition into a low carbon future. So you've got to figure out a way to do both responsibly. And I think, you know, I think policymakers understand that.
And another sort of big issue between both Canada and the States that they're trying to, you know, find agreement on and to confide in each other is just the, I don't know if you want to say threat is the right word, but I guess the mystery card that is China in the world. What do you think about that? I mean, we touched already that Biden is, you know, he's not going to be as unpredictable as Trump, but in terms of, you know, just vying together and economically having trade with China or, you know, doing that at all, given sort of some of the human rights issues over there and some of the ways that government's done, are you, you know, even more optimistic in how Canada and the States can do this together going forward with what is becoming a superpower in Asia?
So there's a lot packed in there. I think the question of China is a vexing one for everyone in the world, including China. And one of the smartest discussions recently that is ongoing about the question of China and how do Western democracies deal with it is actually happening at the Halifax International Security Forum. So I don't know if you're familiar with Halifax, and I'm not sure when this podcast will air, but as we're recording right now, Halifax is underway, and it'll be available online if people want to check it out. But I was just participating in a program on how do you deal with the question of China at Halifax. And there are a number of issues that you mentioned. There's the question of human rights. There's the question of China's ambitions around the world. And there's the question of global commerce and trade. And we have to deal with all of those questions. So I think I would just defer to the Halifax discussions and encourage your listeners to check it out, because they're way smarter than I am. And the issues are so complicated that it bears a deep dive. I mean, the one I'll just mention is the current tensions between China and India over their border, right? That is something that is happening currently. It has big implications for geopolitics and security, and it's something that the world is watching very carefully. But it's unfolding. It's about as opposite as you can get from the Canada-U.S. border when you look at almost any other border in the world. We're pretty lucky, and the China-India tensions in the Himalayas is a perfect example of the contrast.
Okay, a little teaser for that Halifax ensuing item. And in terms of China, I appreciate you just kind of delving into it briefly. I know it is a big issue. Well, I want to be respectful of your time, but I did preface to you beforehand that I wanted to get some sort of analysis on faith, if that's possible, and how the change in White House will affect that. We've seen once again, you know, the results have shown that predominantly evangelicals supporting, you know, Donald Trump in this past election. And I think there was even more of a push, like in his recruitment, that there was evangelicals need to vote for me because of my policies, than even in past Republican politicians dating back to, I want to say, the 60s or 70s, when it was more divided. You are someone of Catholic faith. The new president-elect is someone of Catholic faith. Just talk to me about that for a second, of how that informs him, you think, in issues that evangelicals are worried about, quite frankly, with the threat of radicals, of progressives in the Democratic Party.
Yeah, so you're right that the Christian right, as we call it, supported the Trump administration in fairly big numbers. I think they did it in spite of who he is as a person, and because of what he was able to accomplish with the Republican Senate in terms of judicial appointments. So you see a movement of judges that are quite conservative, and that has been something that has been high on the priority of the Christian right for a long time. And the Trump administration really delivered on those judicial appointments. But he's really not otherwise somebody that I think a person of deep faith could relate to, you know, in his own personal, the way he deals with things. In contrast, you've got Joe Biden, who is not going to appoint the same judges, but he is deeply spiritual and devout. And so there's a way to connect there just at a fundamental level. So I think either way, you know, people of faith will find their way through who they want to support politically. And Joe Biden is a serious, thoughtful leader, and he listens to people, and he's not looking to create divisions. And that's new. We haven't had that for 4 years. We've had a president who really exploits divisions and who looks for them. And if he can drive a wedge and then make it bigger, that's the way he rolls. And so I think you'll see a coming together. It's going to take a while. You know, millions and millions of Americans are really disappointed with the outcome of the election. And it takes a while to work through that. And so Joe Biden isn't going to just on day one be able to bring everybody together and everybody's going to be happy and sing kumbaya. It's going to take some work, but he's going to work at it. He's going to be prayerful about it. I know that. And hopefully people will have an open mind and an open heart about our leaders, and we'll give him a chance to really try to govern. You know, it's a very serious time right now, actually, not to end on a downer note, but we do have this pandemic. We do have an economic challenge. We do have a loss of trust in democratic institutions, and all of those things need to be addressed. And any president will have to address them. And it's a big challenge. So that's what's on the plate for the administration coming in.
It's well known that American imperialism has happened throughout history, you know, in terms of applying capitalism and ensuring that is set. I mean, that goes dating back to the Cold War, and, you know, following up from World War II. And it's, you know, still is, in a lot of ways, America's a big help to so many nations in the world. And we've already touched on how that's going to, you know, I think, change for the better as they're kind of open for business and open for relationship again with Biden going in. But I think imperialism also is deposited into other countries through culture. And American culture is such a precedent-setting place in terms of, I mean, you think of Hollywood, you think of just people that have platforms, it's a big country. I know that, you know, Biden is going to be guiding a little bit different than, you know, what they've been expected in America. I wonder, with all that said, do you think that maybe the more open, the less rigid mantra of Joe Biden will actually maybe show the world, because it's going to be a harder path for Christians to live in the sense of maybe some of their, if they're they're really conservative values, but it will actually pose an opportunity for show them what, you know, Christians do, as opposed to less about what they stand for in terms of helping the poor, in terms of finding ways that they can kind of coexist with the government in the way that the government wants, and a lot of the things that Biden is happy for. I know I lumped a lot into that, but I'm wondering if you think there's actually an opportunity through American culture for Christians to sort of find these access points to work together, rather than what I think is right now this sort of fear of, which I don't think is necessarily, which I don't think necessarily has a lot of merit to it, of what they're going to be up against in terms of maybe bills that will be passed.
Well, I think there's always an opportunity to live your values, right? So I do think imperialism is kind of a loaded word. And, you know, America didn't invent imperialism. You know, you could think of a lot of examples of that around the world. So I do think there's an opportunity to live your values, though. So whether that is through, you know, foreign missionary work, whether that's through helping less fortunate people here at home, like whatever motivates people, I think there's an opportunity to do that. And I think there's really a need, actually. Again, we haven't seen the worst of the pandemic and the economic crisis. It's going to get worse before it gets better, unfortunately. And so I think people of faith and people, you know, as they say, people of faith and people of no faith all need to come together in kind of common cause to help each other and to get through it. So I'm hoping there's an opportunity to do that. I think so. The stakes are enormously high.
Okay. All right. That's a positive note to end on. We've flipped the script a little bit. Thank you very much for your time. Mary Scott Greenwood, CEO of the American Canada Business Council. Lots of ties and lots of interest and knowledge of the Canada-America precedent-setting relationship in the world.
Thank you so much, David Mann. Great to be with you.
Excellent. So a little bit of insight for you on what the future could hold for Canada and the States. Isn't she lovely too? I mean, so willing to lend a hand and so passionate in sustaining this one-of-a-kind relationship we have between our two North American countries. Interesting what she had to say about the role of faith. I wonder if that will be true for how most Christians will feel once Biden does come in the White House. We may have to have her come back on in 6 months just to check in on that territory. As always, if you're interested and want to delve more into anything we chatted about, like the Canadian American Business Council or the Halifax Forum, that will all be linked on the show notes, which you can conveniently find at davidmannmedia.com. Next week, we won't be too far off from Christmas, just in case you're wondering. And with that in mind, this is an especially important time of year to consider those who are less fortunate. So I think it's only timely to bring Michael Messenger, the president and CEO of World Vision Canada, onto the show. Michael is one of the most passionate people I've ever met when it comes to his work. I mean, just loves what he does. You're going to be enthralled by the way he speaks. He also has a particular interest in the more concentrated places of poverty in the world, and he represents, for that matter, the whole organization of World Vision in these fragile contexts. For him, this is the role World Vision has been given by God, and the kind of work that they do, and, you know, it should be attributed more to who Christians are.
I think too often in our society, it's really unfortunate, sad, that Christians are sometimes known what we're not allowing rather than really what we're for. Because at the heart of the gospel, it's about compassion. It's about the fruits of the Spirit. It's about caring for other people.
Michael Messenger is next week. We'll explore the work of the world's largest charity and what this entails in the Canadian chapter. If you want to make sure you never miss an episode, all you got to do is subscribe to Culture at a Crossroads wherever you get your podcasts. We're also on Instagram and Facebook, and we do send out weekly newsletters that include a one-minute devotional just to keep you in the right mode going forward in the week. You can subscribe to that when you head to davidmannmedia.com. Until next week, I'm David Mann for Culture at a Crossroads. Thanks for listening.